Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Wisconsin Education Association Council versus Walker. Mr. Olson.
If it pleases the court, my name is Joseph Olson. I'm with the law firm of Michael Best and Friedrich, and I have the pleasure of having been appointed special counsel to assist the Wisconsin Attorney General in his defense of this matter. I will be presenting argument this morning on behalf of the defendant, appellant cross appellees. Act 10, at its core, represents a legitimate policy decision made by the state of Wisconsin. The state determined that reforming the collective bargaining system for as many state and municipal employees as possible was necessary in order to give the state and municipal governments the flexibility to absorb necessary reductions in state funding. Plaintiff unions claims seek to undermine this policy decision. They've brought two claims in this case. Their first claim is that the differing levels of collective bargaining and privileges made available to public safety and general employees violates the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution. Their second claim is that a prohibition on payroll dues deductions for general employees violates the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. There is no dispute between the parties, and the district court agreed that plaintiff's Equal Protection Clause raises no fundamental rights and is therefore governed only by the rational basis standard. Under this standard, this court is required to uphold Act 10 if there is a rational relationship between the disparity of treatment and some legitimate government purpose. Indeed, a classification must be upheld if there is any reasonable, conceivable state of facts that could provide a rational basis for the classification.
Mr. Olson, if I could ask you about that. I read the district judge's opinion as finding political animus or viewpoint discrimination in the where the line was drawn between public safety employees and general employees with respect to the dues withholding part of Act 10, subjecting it to heightened scrutiny. Assume for purposes of argument that we agree with that finding. I know you disagree, but assume for purposes that we do agree with it. Under that reasoning, why shouldn't that lead us to apply heightened scrutiny under the Equal Protection Clause as well for burdening a fundamental right, political association, for the rest of Act 10?
Well, I think that the reason for that is it would put it in conflict with the numerous Supreme Court and other court decisions that have held that there is no fundamental right to collective bargaining.
Not collective bargaining. The question, there is a fundamental right to engage in political activity, to associate yourself with people on a political basis, and not to be punished for that.
Correct.
So if the dues withholding part of the law is subject to heightened scrutiny based on burdening political speech, why doesn't that reasoning extend to the rest of the law?
Well, I think the reasoning wouldn't extend to the rest of the law because it doesn't. The rest of the law, and again, we're working under the assumption that I agree that the dues deduction should be evaluated under heightened scrutiny. The rest of the law doesn't have any similar impact on the ability of employees to unionize. Nothing in Act 10 prevents an employee from joining a union or from that union petitioning the government, running political ads, supporting candidates for election. The other changes to Act 10 really only deal with the functionality of the collective bargaining system put in place for municipal and state employees. So to the extent that we were going to agree that the dues deduction should be looked at under some level of heightened scrutiny, it's just a different system. It's a different connection between the union, the union's ability to engage in traditional First Amendment activities for that portion of the law than the remainder of the law.
Right, but the reasoning here, though, for heightened scrutiny is based in essence on this kind of odd selection of who's included and who's not included in the public safety group, right? And that rationale would seem to extend, at least your opponents are arguing, that would extend to heightened scrutiny for everything else that depends upon that same line, and that's really the fundamental dichotomy between public safety and general employees.
Well, I think looking at it from that angle, that because the district court thought there may have been political animus, and I read the district court's opinion as saying it there was a suggestion of political animus, but making actually no finding that there was political animus. The difference is that shouldn't take it out of rational basis review. In fact, the case law, including this court's opinion in Hearn versus Board of Education of City of Chicago, makes it abundantly clear that you apply the rational basis test first. And only if you don't find a rational basis do you consider whether political motivations were the primary purpose. In fact, the Hearn court stated that there is no doctrine that takes an otherwise constitutional law and makes it unconstitutional because the court may have been concerned with political animosity. Mm-hmm. So really, when courts have looked at this, they have looked at the political animosity after they've already determined that there was no other conceivable rational basis. And that's not the standard here. So to use political the potential that there was political animus at play to then pull the case out of the rational basis standard, a standard that the district court applied and the parties agreed applied, would really do, I think, would do some violence to the rational basis standard to begin with, and how courts have applied their analysis of political animus.
Let me get at the Hearn question, which I think is a very difficult question in this case. But if the state government decides to fire one employee because of his political activity, and he doesn't fall under an Elrod or Branty kind of policymaking exception, we'd agree, I think, that would violate that employee's First Amendment rights, right?
Yes.
And presumably the same result would apply if the state government demoted that person or put a cap on his raises for political reasons.
If there was solely no other reason, but just and the facts were clear that there was pure just political motivation going against
right.
this individual, I think we would agree. But I think that's a very different.
So let's take it a step at a time.
Okay.
One individual. Okay. Suppose the state does that to 10 people in one office. Still a problem, right?
Yes.
100.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So, explain to me, in essence, what I'm asking you, in essence, is whether the Hearn distinction between group activity or targeting a group mm-hmm. and one or a few individuals holds up under constitutional scrutiny.
I believe that what we're faced with here in our hypothetical is the statement that there was no other motivation. And what the Hearn court is saying, and what the other courts have said, is when there's an otherwise constitutional law, it doesn't become unconstitutional because there may have been a political flavor. And that's what we have here, Your Honor. We have a law that is otherwise constitutional. The rational basis for why the lines were drawn where they were has been stated by the state, it's been argued by the state, and has been upheld by the district court in this case. And that line was drawn where it was, not because of political animus, but because the state determined that to effectuate its goal of reforming its collective bargaining system for as many employees as possible, it needed to counterbalance that against the threat that there may be a disruption in essential public services.
And the counterexample that troubles me, and I'd be interested to hear you address in more detail, as I understand it, your position is that you wanted to avoid the risk of an illegal public employee strike where that would endanger essential public services.
Correct. Right?
So explain to me where the motor vehicle inspectors with the state police fit into that.
Sure, absolutely. There's been a lot of argument about which groups were in put into the public safety category and which were not. And I think we have to approach that first from the standpoint that it's the state, through its legislature and its governor, who are best positioned to make the determination as to which employees do in
sure,
fact provide.
Sure, but we don't just rubber stamp it.
Correct, but which provide these essential services. So looking at the motor vehicle inspectors, they're not just a standalone group of 112 officers. They are a part of the largest state-level police force in the state of Wisconsin. It numbers almost 500 employees. It's just under 500 sworn officers. Those state patrol officers have for their duties the coordination of responses to events with local police and fire, and the coordination with the Department of Homeland Security in the event of larger scale issues. So when we're looking at why...
I understand your argument for police, for troopers. The motor vehicle inspectors are part of the WTA, is that right?
Yes, they are.
Okay. It's a lot easier to understand including them in the essential public safety employee category as fellow members of the WTA than it is as we can't possibly tolerate any interruption in motor vehicle inspections.
I think, and Your Honor, I think we're looking at it from the wrong perspective. It's not that the state said we can't possibly tolerate the disruption of the specific services that the inspectors provide on a day-to-day basis. It's that if there were a disruption in services, the motor vehicle inspectors are part of a state agency that is primarily responsible for helping to coordinate with local police in their handling of those situations. So if there's going to be a reduction of workforce, if there's going to be certain public employees who are gone, who aren't there because of job actions or strikes, and there is the necessity for the state to help coordinate a response, those motor vehicle inspectors are part of the state's primary police force, the primary agency that does that coordinating work. And so keeping them in makes complete sense because they have the same training as the troopers. They go through the same academy. They have the same job responsibilities. In the normal course, they may focus primarily on motor vehicle inspection, but they are there in a supporting role to support the troopers and to do the same job that the troopers do when called upon to do so. Additionally, I think the other problems with the circuit court's reliance on political favoritism as a motive is that the evidence, really the lack of evidence in the record, makes it clear that there's been no substantiation that political motivations are what drove this. The plaintiffs throughout this case have relied on a single statement of one legislature and then the 2010 gubernatorial endorsement record. Neither one of those really make it clear, demonstrate a clear pattern of political favoritism. And I think in light of the statements from Hearn and from the United States Supreme Court and O'Brien, that courts should be leery to ascribe political animus to the government when it is passing legislation, that there's just simply not enough evidence in this record for any court to conclude that political favoritism is what drove Act 10. To the extent that the court is going to listen to the statements of any single actor in this, I would suggest that the statements of the governor made at the initial press conference where he introduced Act 10 to the legislature, describing in detail what Act 10 was going to do and addressing the very issue that this court just questioned me about, why include the state patrol and not other state-level law enforcement, those were all made very clear, and it was the distinction being made that the state of Wisconsin, in its legitimate role as the policymaker, had decided that there were certain public safety employees who provided certain essential services that the state could not do without in the event of a mass job action. The district court, as you are aware, struck down the recertification provisions, and we contend in this appeal that that was erroneous. First, we disagree with the district court that there was no rational connection between the threat of a strike and the recertification provisions. The threat of a strike was just as potential with the recertification provisions as it was with the rest of Act 10. And it is the district court's carving out of the recertification provisions on their own that we think was problematic under the rational basis standard. When the legislature and the governor were enacting Act 10, they considered the potential impacts of Act 10 as a whole, as a package of collective bargaining changes that were made. And they determined what they thought a potential reaction from the employees might be with regard to the package as a whole. So for the court to divide out the recertification provisions or the dues deduction provisions and give them a separate and distinct rational basis analysis seems antithetical, again, to this rational basis standard, which asks this court to look at what the legislature did and determine if there is any reasonable, conceivable state of facts that would justify those actions. Additionally, the recertification standards have additional rational bases in and of themselves. And probably the clearest one is that the new recertification provisions effectuate the state's policy of providing most of it, as many of its employees as possible, with a greater choice in the process and decision as to of whether or not to have a certified bargaining agent. Under the new recertification provisions, every employee's voice will be counted, whether they choose to vote in favor of certification or not.
Do we find that argument in the district court record?
Yes. This argument was made in our response brief on summary judgment. But I would argue that even if it wasn't, given what the rational basis standard is that that this court can even speculate or hypothesize new bases as it does its work, there's nothing improper for new arguments being raised at this stage. Additionally, the higher recertification threshold for general employees is rational because the general employees' reduced bargaining scope, the scope of their bargaining privileges, means that the general employees' unions are largely irrelevant to the state's ability or desire to institute reforms. Additionally, a higher turnover of certified bargaining agents in the context of general employees doesn't present any sort of problems with having a long-term bargaining partner at the state.
It does make me wonder, in essence, you've neutered the unions for general employees so much, what's the point of the recertification provision?
What's the point of the recertification provision? Yeah. Well, I think
it's all that's left is just a facade of collective bargaining. So.
I don't think it is a facade, Your Honor. They still can bargain over base wages, which I think is the core.
Up to the CPI.
Up to the CPI, that's correct.
Come on.
Well, Your Honor,
there's nothing left.
Well, the state of Wisconsin could have ended collective bargaining completely,
right.
And they chose not to. They found what they believed was a middle ground that allowed even general employees to have some collective bargaining privileges. Concomitant with the reduction in the scope of bargaining, because the certified bargaining agent is charged with less and has less opportunity to bargain, it also makes rational sense then that the general employees have a larger say, an annual say, on whether or not they want to continue to be represented by a collective bargaining agent. Under the old system, 30% of the general employees in the collective bargaining unit would have had to sort of out themselves as being against their union, as not wanting the union to continue to represent them. They no longer have to do that. Now they have an annual election where they're allowed to voice their pleasure or displeasure with the certified bargaining agent, and that effectuates a policy of employee choice. Additionally, when it comes to reforming government and how government operates, because the general employee unions have less ability to impact that role, the state of Wisconsin no longer has a rational basis for supporting a policy that basically creates a union that very likely will never go away. But instead now, because the general employee unions are less important, they get subject to this annual recertification provision. The plaintiff's second claim deals specifically with the dues deduction provision. And that dues deduction provision was analyzed under the First Amendment. Throughout the course of the case, it's been a little bit difficult to divine exactly what the plaintiffs were arguing their claim was. At some points, it was analyzed as a subsidy, and in this court, they settled on a non-public forum theory. Unfortunately for plaintiffs, neither one of these theories gets them any relief under the First Amendment. The Wycersa, Reagan, and Davenport cases make it abundantly clear that the state doesn't have an obligation to provide these dues checkoffs. It doesn't have an obligation to subsidize their union activities.
That's clear.
You're into your rebuttal, sir.
Oh.
If I could just ask you, though, now about the dues withholding provision briefly. First of all, what payroll deductions are allowed in Wisconsin for state employees?
For state employees, payroll deductions are allowed for public service employees to employee organizations. Donations can be made to charitable organizations when approved by the governor.
I assume that has to be viewpoint neutral?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And you've got also benefits and retirement contributions and all kinds of deductions. Like
correct.
That, right? Let me just ask you what concerns me about the payroll deduction issue here. Indiana used to have a system whereby we had payroll deductions for state employees for direct contributions to the state parties. Okay, 2% of your salary was the normal expectation. I suspect that probably would have been a felony in Wisconsin 20 years ago, but that was Indiana law. But I would have thought it would be pretty clear that the state could not allow payroll deductions for one party and not for the other. Would you agree with that?
That would seem problematic, yes.
Right. And I guess the question here then, with the payroll deduction provision here, mm-hmm. that the district court subjected to heightened scrutiny, is whether the answer should be any different if the theory is this was discriminatory based on political affiliation of the unions involved.
Well, I think there's a necessary first step that has been skipped over by the plaintiffs in their arguments, and that is an analysis of what's the purpose of the form. And here I think it's pretty clear that the purpose of the form was to allow payroll deductions for those unions who have what is now a unique employment relationship with the state and their municipal employers. At this, after the passage of Act 10, dues deductions are available for those public employees that have full collective bargaining rights. And the political animus angle falls completely away here, because included in those employees who have full collective bargaining rights are transit employees, employees that have nothing to do with which unions did or didn't back the governor in the 2010 election. And those transit employees who also have full collective bargaining rights also have the ability to have their dues deducted. So we have to look first at what is the purpose of the forum. And here the forum is to provide dues deductions for those unions that have full collective bargaining rights. And that analysis is of who is allowed to use the forum and not is subjected to a reasonableness standard. And the state is allowed to make speaker-based determinations and subject matter, sometimes called content-based determinations. And if those determinations of who has access to the forum are looked at as to whether or not it's reasonable. And here it is reasonable because of the unique employment relationship. And I see I'm now on my yellow light. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Chappelle?
Thank you, Your Honor. I am Milton Chappelle, and I represent the non-union employees who sought to intervene in this case and were denied intervention by the district court because the district court felt that the state would adequately represent their interests. However, the record shows that the state failed to represent their interests, and actually through that failure, my clients have been prejudiced. Specifically, the district court stated that the reason that it struck down both the recertification requirement of Act 10 and the prohibition on union dues deductions was because the state had provided no rational basis, no basis at all, or no additional basis to support those two provisions. And the proposed interveners filed amicus briefs where they presented to the court alternative rational basis for those two specific parts of the law that the district court struck down, and they presented controlling Supreme Court argument that the state did not present, which would have validated the two provisions at issue. And they also presented an alternative remedy for a different outcome if the court found any equal protection violation, which again the state did not present. And so I'd like to point out, because one of these goes to the questions that Judge Hamilton was asking, one of the cases not presented by the state but presented by the proposed interveners was Davenport, a Supreme Court case, in which the court held, first off, that there is no constitutional right for unions to have the power to force non-members to pay any money to the union, that is a statutory grace. And the court went on, which is really key to the First Amendment analysis that we believe the district court made a mistake in, and we believe he made the mistake because he was not provided the Davenport case by the state. The court went on to say that when the state has the ability to outlaw or make the change, there's no fundamental constitutional rights at all, so they could stop dues deductions altogether, but they decide to do a subset, there is no content-based discrimination. There's no First Amendment content-based discrimination. The court then followed Davenport 2 years later in the USERSA case and held that the same rationale for First Amendment content-based discrimination applied to the deduction of union dues. And they said that, first of all, the state has no constitutional obligation to provide payroll deductions at all. And the court went on to find that there was no violation under equal protection or the First Amendment because even if the state is cutting off the political deductions, that doesn't impair the First Amendment political rights of unions because the unions are still free to make political speech, to make political contributions, and to raise political funds just like any other group because the dues deductions is a subsidy which the state can give and take without the constitutional viewpoint analysis or even rational basis equal protection. And there is no constitutional requirement on the state to subsidize political. The only thing they are told not to do is to prohibit it. They're not prohibiting it. And actually, the unions and their political involvement under pre-Act 10 or before Act 10 were actually getting that subsidy from the state that put them at a greater ability to be involved in the political process than other groups who were not being given political or dues deductions. So the state now has just gone back and said, we're going to stay neutral in this area, especially when we don't have a full bargaining representative.
That's really the question, though, isn't it? I mean, in the Pocatello, USERSA case, the court was pretty specific, wasn't it, in saying, well, if you can be neutral, but if you're not going to be even-handed in this, then we'll consider an as-applied challenge, right?
Right, but I do not believe this is an as-applied challenge. This is a facial challenge, and the state has given a rational basis that has nothing to do with politics for the decisions made here for the reforms enunciated in Act 10. And as the state just argued, the court only gets to the potential of political animus if they can find no basis for a rational basis. And then the court must find actual political animus or proof of political favoritism. It cannot base that on mere speculation. And the unions have never claimed they have the proof or the smoking gun. They keep going, well, let's look at this alignment. Let's look at this. Let's look at this statement. It looks like that the only way you can make sense of this, because they poo-poo the rational basis being presented by the state, is this suspicion of political animus or trying to go against the political enemies of the current political party. Again, Hearn speaks directly to that. But the court didn't have the Davenport case by us being left out. And the court didn't have to consider because we were not parties. We also presented the Inquist case where the Supreme Court said that in equal protection analysis that there is a lesser standard that a state has to make to pass rational basis when it is acting as the employer as opposed to the regulator. The union cited to the district court, and the district court used the regulator cases of applying the equal protection standard when the government is regulating conduct. But it did not address, nor did it apply, the lesser standard, which gives the government much greater discretion when it is acting as the employer and dealing with its employees. And so, again, the district court was precluded from having this lesser standard, did not analyze it, and my clients were prejudiced because of this. And unless the court has some other questions, we've outlined more things in our brief, the alternative remedy and other places. I will stop now, and if I have a few minutes, give that back for his rebuttal, if that's okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chappelle.
Thank you.
So, Diane?
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Leon Diane. I'm here for the appellees. There are three sets of provisions of Act 10 that are at issue in this case. I'd like to start by discussing the provisions that the district court struck down on both First Amendment and equal protection grounds. And those, of course, are the dues deduction provisions that have been discussed. After that, I'll turn to the bargaining provisions and the recertification provisions. In considering the constitutionality of the dues deduction provisions, I think it's very important to keep in mind at the outset that Wisconsin law does not tie the ability of an employee association to participate in the dues deduction system to whether or not the association has collective bargaining or exclusive bargaining authority. An association can participate with that respect to whether it's a majority exclusive representative, and with that respect even whether it aspires to that. That was true of Wisconsin law before Act 10, and it remains true of the law under Act 10. Now, as we set out in our brief, way back in 1955, before Wisconsin allowed any collective bargaining at all, it had a payroll deduction system that it had set up by statute. And by definition, since there was no bargaining, participation in that system didn't turn on whether you were a bargaining representative. It just turned on whether you were a, quote, employee organization. So that was the law beginning in 1955. It remained the law right up to Act 10. Act 10 didn't change that framework. All Act 10 did was exclude one class of employees and employee organizations from participating and leave in, of course, the public safety employees and their organizations. So it remains the case that a public safety employee organization with no collective bargaining rights, either because it's a minority union or because it doesn't aspire to a bargain, it's more of a professional association, for example. Either way, that kind of organization can participate, and who's left out are the non-public safety unions. So that's important, I think, because it shows that the issue is analytically distinct from the bargaining issue. And it also, I think, helps illustrate why the framework we propose, which I think is the suitable one, it's the most analogous one from the case law, is this sort of non-public forum analysis that's been developed by the Supreme Court and also by this court in the Chicago Acorn case that we cited in our brief and in the Southworth case that we cited in our brief. Under that framework, as we laid out in the brief, the state can close off a forum altogether. And here I should say, we've been clear in our briefs, you've been clear throughout, that under ESRSA, absolutely, the state of Wisconsin could terminate the entire system of payroll deductions and prohibit, you know, all payroll deductions to organizations. If it doesn't do that, though, and it leaves open a system for deduction of dues, it has to be even-handed. The kind of forum that can be withdrawn altogether is the non-public forum, and there are rules even for non-public fora. The two rules that, the black letter test is that the rules have to be reasonable and viewpoint neutral, and we focused on the viewpoint neutral piece of it. And it's that viewpoint neutral prong that Act 10 runs afoul of. And it's so not just because of the sort of peculiar line drawing, which I'll get to in a minute. It's so because, just by definition, different unions are apt to advocate for different interests. And certainly law enforcement unions are apt to advocate for different interests than social worker unions. And when there's a realistic risk of viewpoint discrimination, that's sufficient under the test. So to take a step back, the Supreme Court has been clear that in a non-public forum, regulations have to be reasonable and viewpoint discriminatory. The Supreme Court's also been clear that in testing whether the regulation of a public forum is truly viewpoint neutral, it's not sufficient that the rules are facially viewpoint neutral. As long as they can operate in ways that discriminate on the basis of viewpoint, that's from Lamb's Chapel, or if they're a facade for viewpoint discrimination, they're improper, and that's the Cornelius case. And this court, in a pair of cases that I think are quite closely on point, Chicago Acorn and Southworth, drove that point home. In both of those cases, you had rules governing access to non-public forums that were facially viewpoint neutral, but that the court looked behind and said, well, there's too great of a risk of viewpoint discrimination in operation here. In Acorn, what you had before you was the Chicago Pier Authority allowing the Democratic Party to use facilities at a discounted rate and then denying that same access to Chicago, to an Acorn group and an SEIU local union. The court said that the city justified that on the basis of the size of the organization. They said the Democratic Party is an established organization. It'll bring more business to the pier to let them on. It's rational for us to provide more favorable access to them than to other groups. This court disagreed, saying that that the rule tended to favor establishment organizations over fledgling organizations, and that in turn could be viewpoint discriminatory. In Southworth, you had a student activity fund operated by the University of Wisconsin, which concededly could have been taken away altogether. But instead, the University of Wisconsin maintained the fund and then had rules governing access by student organizations to the fund, private student organizations.
Mr. Diane, do you think that those factual settings, those vignettes you described, are analogous to a public safety versus a general employees distinction?
I think they are, for two reasons. First of all, here, well, as I said, I think you can, you know, it's clear from the out, it should be reasonably clear just from the outset that a union set up to advocate for example, law enforcement employees is apt to have a different view of the world on at least some issues, and that's all that really matters.
Well, arguably every union might have a slightly different perspective on a given issue.
And if you're going to distinguish between different kinds of expressive associations and access to a public forum, you are creating an inherent risk of viewpoint discrimination. So there needs to be some non-viewpoint based rationale that that can sustain the distinction and that can eliminate the risk of viewpoint discrimination in operation. Here I think it's stronger than just looking at the inherent propensities of the different kinds of unions that are in and are out. We have, of course, undisputed record evidence that the distinction isn't even between truly public safety unions and other unions. Public safety is the label applied to a kind of mishmash of unions, and the label, as we showed in our brief extensively, was gerrymandered in a way that tracks the endorsements in the 2010 elections. In other words, there were 22 categories of protective service employees prior to Act 10. What the legislature did, or what seems to explain what they did better than anything else, is they went through, and if a group that endorsed the governor, any group that endorsed the governor, its little subclassification, its one of the 22, would be deemed public safety. And when they were done with that, everything else was general employees. So what you have is a system where, for example, the prison guards are not considered public safety employees, and as Judge Hamilton was pointing out, the vehicle inspectors are public safety employees. The Capitol Police are not public safety employees, even though the original and sole rationale that was advanced for the distinctions in the statute was this rationale that supposedly they were afraid of a general backlash strike in response to the act itself. It wasn't until the appeal here that the state said, well, we didn't just create the category to deal with an immediate crisis. The category makes sense from a longer-term perspective as well. Well, the original rationale was the immediate prevention of disruption that could be caused if there was some sort of general strike or illegal action. And yet the Capitol Police, who you would think would be the most, would be right at the forefront of the type of law enforcement officials you'd want on the job, are treated as general employees. So our submission is that it doesn't make sense that the stated rationale isn't the actual rationale, that the objective asserted for the statute isn't the real one. And in the First Amendment, when the First Amendment is implicated, certainly that is a greater showing of a risk of viewpoint discrimination than you saw in either the Acorn or the Southworth case. So, you know, I would submit that our case is stronger than those two.
Mr. Diane, let me ask you what troubles me a good deal about this case, which is the idea, I'm basically getting at the problem in Hearn against Chicago Board of Education. in the idea that public policy choices that wind up promoting the interests of those who supported those with power and hurt other people are kind of the way we do politics in this country. The example that came to mind to kind of simplify it would be, let's suppose a state faces a choice between more funding for prisons and more funding for universities. Maybe to capture the current circumstances, it would be, let's suppose they have to cut one of those. The prison guards support one party in its candidates. The university unions support the other party and its candidates. And then the winner makes its choice. Does the political correlation between support and the policy consequences justify heightened scrutiny in challenging those budgetary decisions? If it does, frankly, I'd be very troubled.
Yeah, it is not our position that it does. In fact, we would agree we haven't challenged Hearn in the least. The way I read Hearn, I think it's the proper way to read it, is that if a statute otherwise is permissible, just from the examination of the statute, the fact that there might be secret glee that you know your political opponents are going to be worse off than they would have been otherwise doesn't invalidate the law. And I would agree that if you open the door to that kind of analysis, you would throw a lot of legislation at risk. So what our position is that this case is very different from Hearn, because we're not saying, like they did in Hearn. In Hearn, the only distinction made in that statute was between the city of Chicago and the rest of the state. That was the only distinction. The court pointed out that distinction was a logical distinction, Chicago being the only super urban area of the state, and a distinction that suffused Illinois law. Here, the distinction that's made is a newfangled distinction created just for this one statute and one statute only that has what the district court called suspect line drawing within it. So we're not going outside the statute and saying, look who supported it, look who opposed it. We're looking at the statute itself. We're saying, why on earth would the legislature have excluded, for example, the Capitol Police? Why would they have excluded state police, like the University of Wisconsin Police and other state police, kept in municipal police? Why would they have kept out prison guards? None of this seems to make any sense if you look at the stated objective of the statute. We're only looking at who endorsed whom to say, well, there, that irrational scheme, a light goes on. It's a political payback distinction and not a substantive policy distinction. And in that regard, the case is a lot like the Supreme Court's decision in Department of Agriculture versus Moreno. There, the court was just applying rational basis scrutiny. It wasn't applying heightened scrutiny. And the issue was an amendment to the food stamp statute that excluded certain kinds of unrelated households or households constituting unrelated members from participation. And the challenger said that all that was going on was it was an effort to for Congress to use the food stamp program to essentially show animus towards a certain kind of lifestyle, the hippie lifestyle. The government did not suggest that that would have been a proper purpose. The government said, no, if you look at it under the rational basis test, these rules help prevent fraud. And the Supreme Court said the nexus between this set of rules about related families and fraud is so attenuated that it doesn't fit. And what does fit is this other purpose that was lurking out there. And the court did all of that without inquiring into individual legislators' motives, and we're not suggesting that that's the analysis. I mean, we think it's relevant when you're looking at a statute and trying to figure out whether there's a rational basis for it that the Senate Majority Leader said one advantage of this statute is, or actually what he said is, now that we've passed this statute, it's going to be more difficult for President Obama to carry the state of Wisconsin. Well, you know, we're not saying that that would be sufficient to invalidate an otherwise permissible law, but what we are saying is that it throws those kind of crazy quilt classifications into some order and suggest that the actual purpose is not a permissible purpose. So,
is your position, Mr. Diane, if the Capitol Police and the guards were included, you'd have no problem?
If the legislation had not kind of gone out of its way to make arbitrary distinctions, then certainly on the bargaining, the subjects of bargaining provision, we would agree that we would have a we'd have a very difficult time of it, because as we agree with the other side that there has been a tradition of deference to determining which classifications are entitled to bargain over which subjects and which classifications aren't. What you don't have, and what the state can't cite, is a case where there's no rational distinction, or the line isn't drawn according to any rational criterion that relates to the stated objective of the statute. So we would reject, the right to work position, which the state I think appropriately rejects, is that there's no review at all. I don't think there's any authority for that. The cases do apply a rational basis standard, and here we've shown that it can't meet that standard. I will say this, that our point in looking at the distinctions and looking at the anomalies is not to say, oh, the legislature goofed and should have thought more carefully about the Capitol Police. Our point is much broader than that. It's that those anomalies are a window into the purpose of the entire amendment. So that's why we're challenging the amendment. We're not sort of nibbling around the edges and saying, well, they should, if they thought more deeply about it, they would have put another group in.
Relevant to Judge Flom's question, though, I understand your point about the collective bargaining rights and the limitations on that. I understood what you were said earlier to be, though, that if the state wants to discriminate for dues withholding between different unions, that there's kind of an inherent risk of viewpoint discrimination.
That is absolutely right. So I hope I was careful to say that only that had the statute been one that picked up all 22 protective service occupations or didn't mm-hmm. have these kind of strange anomalies and mm-hmm. over-inclusive examples and under-inclusive classifications, the bargaining issue would be one that would be difficult for us to sustain. However, that's why I started with the dues deduction point and said that it stands on its own and is separate from the collective bargaining piece, because that is and has been maintained as a sort of non-public forum. Actually, that's the most generous view of it from our point of view is that it's a non-public forum. You could argue that given the statutory creation of it and the fact that charitable groups can participate, it's something more than a non-public forum. But our point is that even giving it sort of the most restrictive cast, it runs afoul of the First Amendment case law and this court's decisions in Southworth and Chicago Acorn.
Mr. Diane, there's one other thing I wanted to ask you, and I hope Mr. Olson might also address this on rebuttal. That is, if you could just tell us, what is the status quo right now in terms of what was enjoined, what's happened, what's stayed, et cetera?
Sure. So the district court enjoined in its original order, the one that's being appealed, mm-hmm. enjoined all of the provisions that relate to the dues deduction. The court also enjoined the...
So dues withholding is continuing now for all unions.
Well, let me do it one step at a time.
Okay.
So that was what was enjoined. And then, of course, the court also enjoined the recertification provisions. But then the state moved for a stay, and the court granted that stay motion only in part. So I hope I'm getting this right. But what happened is that the court stayed the application of the recertification provisions prospectively from the date of its decision. So no unions that otherwise would be subject to one of these recertification elections is being forced to recertify under those provisions, whereas those unions that already had not been recertified are deemed as uncertified. The court also then applied the dues deduction, and there's still litigation before the district court on this. That's why it's a more complicated answer than you might expect. But right now, the district court enjoined did enjoin the dues deduction limitation and is allowing dues deduction, but only for those unions that are not decertified. And there's a discussion, and the court asked for further briefing on whether that made sense or whether he should allow the dues deduction to resume even for the non-certified. That's where it stands.
Thank you.
So on the issue of recertification, what I would add is that obviously if you find, and the state doesn't even argue otherwise, if you find that the core bargaining provisions, on the provisions dealing with the subjects of bargaining, are invalid because they're not supported by a rational basis, and that the lines drawn are arbitrary, there's no grounds that the state has put forward for why the recertification provisions could survive. In other words, I think the way I understand their position is that if the bargaining provisions survive, if the bargaining provisions fail, then so too do the recertification provisions. So our position is that even if the bargaining provisions do survive, then what the district court did, which is to say that although those survive, the recertification provisions are still problematic. We agree that that's a logical way, that makes sense. In other words, if the distinction suffuse both categories. So if the bargaining provisions fail, so too do the recertification provisions. The recertification provisions have an added defect, and that's, I think, why the district court drew the line the way it did, which is that it's hard to even see the nexus between the recertification process, or the process for determining who is a collective bargaining representative in the state, and the objectives put forward by the state, which are these strike prevention objectives, either to prevent an immediate backlash strike, which was the rationale below, or the new objective, which is to create long-term stability in public safety unions. In neither case does the recertification distinction go to that. There's no reason to believe that there was a threat of strikes over being excluded or being treated differently for purposes of certification or recertification.
Mr. Dan, there's the recent case of Madison Teachers versus Walker impact any of the analysis in this case?
This is the state court case?
Yeah.
There was very recently a decision from a state trial court that the short answer is that we think you should go ahead and decide this case. It stands separately. There's no abstention principle or any other principle that we're aware of that would say that this case shouldn't go forward and be decided. On top of that is the fact that that is a recent decision that I believe the state has already sought a stay with respect to and has expressed their intention to appeal. So it's not like it's close to being done in the state court system. I mean, I could see that if it had already been argued by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, you might, not because of abstention or any requirement, say, well, if there's a state ground that the state courts are about to take care of, we could see if we could save some effort here. Here, I think it's too early in that process to suggest that these proceedings should be stayed, whether formally or informally. There's certainly no grounds that we're aware of for a formal stay or a formal doctrine that would require this court not to go forward. We're asserting only federal claims. We're proceeding under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. That case was filed in state court asserting only state grounds in the complaint. So that's why it wasn't removable and why it's being litigated in the state forum. I'd be open to any further questions. I think I've discussed all three issues here. I'll say on the recertification piece, the rationales that were put forward, they have the strong odor of being what they are, which is after-the-fact rationales. We realize that under the rational basis jurisprudence, the court can look at rationales posited after the statute was adopted and even after the first round of litigation. It's also true that when the defendant is reaching for new rationales, there's reason to greet that with skepticism. And the notion, for example, that the recertification provisions, what we heard actually from counsel is that the recertification provisions have a more, according to counsel, are more democratic and open in determining a more open and democratic process for members to determine their representative. We would dispute that premise out of hand because under the rules, as we said in our brief, 70% of the members can vote. 70% of the members can vote yes. You do the math, that's a 49% vote. And what would in any other context be viewed as the overwhelming employee choice is rejected under Act 10. So we reject the premise. The more important point is that we still haven't heard a reason for why it makes more sense to apply that to to general employees than to public safety employees. If anything, the greater power that the public safety employees continue to have would suggest that if you really believed that this was a better system for determining choice, that you would apply it to them as well. There's no rationale that we can conceive of. I mean, you can have different theories about how to determine a majority representative, but we haven't heard any theory as to why one system should be appropriate for one type of representative and another system should be appropriate for a different type of representative. So I will wrap it up with those remarks, and thank you for...
Thank you, Mr. Diane. Mr. Olson?
Thank you, Your Honors. I think the first point needs to be made on rebuttal, and we've heard a lot about suspect line drawing, and I think quilt was used at one point. And to the extent that this court is actually interested in where the lines were drawn as being suspect, it's important to realize that we're dealing with two separate statutes here, the state collective bargaining system and the municipal collective bargaining system. And with regard to the municipal collective bargaining system, there is not a single law enforcement officer or firefighter in a non-supervisory position that was included in the old public protective services occupation that's not included in the public safety category under Act 10. So to the extent that this panel is disturbed by where the lines were drawn, the lines for MERA, for the Municipal Employment Relations Act, cover everyone that could have been covered. additionally, counsel stated that we haven't cited or we haven't provided any case where there's been sort of a carving up within the public safety category with a similar rationale that we provided. That's just incorrect. We've cited Margiotta versus Kay, which is out of the Eastern District of New York, and that was a case where the state provided certain collective bargaining privileges to what it deemed to be public safety employees or law enforcement, I think was the phrase they used, but they cut out court security officers. The court in that case rejected the argument that it was irrational because they left out this group, and instead the court acknowledged that the court safety officers performed many of the same functions as other law enforcement, had the same powers as other law enforcement, and their exclusion was acceptable, and the court relied on the doctrine that the state is not required to draw lines with precision. Additionally, I think we actually ended up here with some agreement that we don't look to political motivations unless there's no rational basis found. The Moreno court didn't say, gosh, this is a close call, so we're going to find that it's politically motivated. It first found no rational basis and then went to political motivation, and I see that my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken.